Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, now New York as the capital of capital. That's the title of a new book based on a Museum of the City of New York exhibition about the history of banking and its complicated, emotionally fraught, and economically boom and bust relationship with the history of New York. Joining us are the authors of the book and curators of the exhibit, two of them, historian Stephen Jaffe and Jessica Lawton. Thank you both very much.
It's great to be here.
The full book title, Capital of Capital, Money, Banking, and Power in New York City, 1784 to 2012. Why did New York first become the nation's lead banking center, Stephen? Why not one of the other East Coast port cities like Philadelphia or Baltimore or Norfolk, Virginia?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, in the very earliest years, in the late 1700s and into the early 1800s, New York, Philadelphia, to some extent Boston, were all jockeying to be, if you will, the capital of capital. And in fact, in the earliest years, Philadelphia did take the lead, partly because the government established the Bank of the United States, a quasi-public and private institution in Philadelphia. But by the 1830s, because New York City really had become the premier seaport in the young United States, its commerce was surpassing every other city, imports and exports. Merchants were pooling their capital, their profits, in banks, lending that money back out to themselves and other merchants. And so that by the 1830s, New York really outstrips Philadelphia and the other cities.
So banking follows commerce and then creates commerce. And just it's such a funny paradox that New York developed as an archetypal banking city and an archetypal liberal city, including a union city and an alternative culture city with a strong anti-capitalist streak. Did those things happen despite each other or because of each other? Stephen, you want that?
I think it's a very interesting sort of choreography in the city's history between the business core and the what we think of as the liberal or even leftist legacy of the city, which, you know, largely has to do with immigration, which brought many poor people here, people with traditions that were anti-capitalist or at least scrutinized capitalism very critically. And it was also because of the labor movement, because of the industrialization in the city. You had the union movement. The irony or the complexity of this, of course, is that many of the immigrants, really all of the immigrants to speak of, came here because bankers were investing money in shipping that then could afford to go to Europe and bring them over. And I think you've always had this interesting sort of symbiosis in the city's history between banks and its critics and their critics.
And therefore, we become the epicenter of the mortgage securities frenzy and Occupy Wall Street.
Yes.
And the book tells us this kind of contrast is nothing new, going all the way back to the Panic of 1792. So I'll bite. What was the Panic of 1792?
Well, Wall Street, which already was becoming Wall Street in that period, became a kind of manic market for the sale of the stock of the First Bank of the United States, this bank that was founded by the government and for U.S. government bonds at the time. And basically you have the classic speculative boom and bust where prices keep rising as people are buying from each other and selling to each other. And finally the prices peak and the market collapses and it ruins numerous people, including William Dewar, who had been Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Alexander Hamilton, who ruined himself numerous investors and lenders, so much so that when he was put in the city's debtor's jail, New Yorkers ringed the jail in an attempt to lynch him. So that was the panic of the first of many.
This could happen today if any of the bankers actually went to jail over the financial crisis of 2008. Another example, the 1930s, when you say Jacksonian working men protested against the wealthy aristocrats, using that word aristocrats, and all these cycles of prosperity followed by unpredictable downturns, as you put it, generating questions about the complicity of New York bankers in greed-driven risk-taking. You cite 1792, which we discussed, 1837, that Jacksonian thing, 1857, 1873, 1893, 1907, the famous 1929, and the famous 2008. So, Jessica, in 2008, when Lehman Brothers was allowed to go under and the economy fell off a cliff, did you take a deep breath in your office and say, here we go again, it's 1857 all over again?
Right. Well, I think you actually point to what we see as one of the great strengths of this book, which is that it's the first book to take this comprehensive look at the growth of the banking industry in New York City from 1784 to the near present. And so by looking at this long span of time, it's only by looking at this long span of time that you're able to see these cycles, as you mentioned, of boom and bust over and over again. And so, yes, as historians, that's certainly something that we took note of. And I think both in the exhibition and in the book, through the combination of text and images, you can see these vivid cycles of panic.
It's fascinating. And you write that by 1834, all three major types of banks were created here. Mm-hmm. Savings banks, commercial banks, and investment banks. Of course, one of the biggest stories of our lifetimes is that the banks fought to erase those distinctions, which contributed to the collapse of 2008. Right. But why did they develop separately to begin with as savings and commercial banks separate from the investment or Wall Street banks?
Because initially each did serve very different functions. The first banks were commercial banks. They were banks of deposit and discount, meaning that you had accounts and investments that then were loaned out at interest, of course, to businessmen. The savings banks, which New York City really pioneered for the United States in 1819, the New York Bank for Savings, 1819, was really initially a philanthropy. It was an effort by fairly well-heeled merchants and other businessmen to encourage the so-called respectable poor who were flooding into the city from Europe and from the countryside looking for work and prosperity, to get poor people to understand that instead of allegedly squandering their money on drink or luxuries they really shouldn't try to buy, they should scrimp and save and put savings in a bank, and then that capital would be loaned out or invested in safe instruments that would earn interest. What that did, and this is where there's a curveball in our story of New York always being a center of robber baron banking and tycoons and rapacious greed. What the savings banks did with all this capital from working and middle class New Yorkers was to build the Erie Canal. One third of the capital that went into the state built Erie Canal in the 1820s came from the New York Bank for Savings. That meant that this amazing artery of commerce that was built across New York State to the frontier west and that brought that much more commerce to New York and helped enhance and continue to grow its economy really owed a lot to the passbook accounts of ordinary New Yorkers.
But you're talking here about something that's a new historical concept to me, which is bank as philanthropy rather than bank as profit-making company.
Mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm.
Right, and that changed over time. Once the money, once the millions of dollars that New York City and other savings banks were able to pool.
Like, oh, we can make money at this.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so eventually you get the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s,
right.
A complicated story in itself having to do with deregulation in part. But you were also talking about investment banking, which was really grew out of the desire for securities, for stocks and bonds in canals, in railroads eventually, in state and municipal governments. And New York Wall Street businessmen discovered that they could be the middlemen, basically selling stocks and bonds being issued by American governments and American companies by the 1830s and 40s, that they could be the middlemen selling those securities to wealthy investors who wanted to buy them, including many Europeans and many English investors and lenders. And in fact, New York became the conduit through which English capital really flowed through the entire American economy.
Stephen Jaffe and Jessica Lawton here talking about their book and Museum of the City of New York exhibition, Capital of Capital, Money, Banking, and Power in New York City, 1784 to 2012. Is there a moment in history that today most resembles?
Oh, goodness. I mean, there are so many different ways to take that question. I mean, you know, we were talking before the show about what's going on in the news today regarding banking. I mean, you could take it from the angle of looking at the place of women on Wall Street and the extent to which it's still largely a boys' club. You could look at Bitcoin and the uncertainty over what it is that money actually means and the direction it's going in, which harkens back to the various stages of the evolution of money, whether it be the proliferation of banknotes before the creation of a federal currency, when people didn't know how much something was worth or it was worth what a merchant was willing to give them in exchange.
That we were talking about how that sort of the brave new – Jessica and I were chatting about how the brave new world of Bitcoin very much resembles what New Yorkers and other Americans were going through 150 years ago during the Civil War when the Lincoln administration and Salmon P. Chase, Lincoln's Treasury Secretary, with the aid of New York's
– Was he that Chase, by the way?
He's that Chase. He is that Chase. New York's bankers helping Chase and Lincoln do this basically converted in two or three legislative acts a mess of a currency system in this country into basically what we still have today, which is the uniform federally backed cash, the paper currency that we had. Before that, you would walk around the streets of New York or anywhere else in the country with your pocket or your wallet full of banknotes of different denominations, sizes, origins. Individual banks issued the money supply, in other words.
So whether it was Savings Bank for the Working People in 1819 or a unified currency in the Civil War or collateralized debt obligations in the 2000s,
yep.
New York is a center of banking innovation, for better or worse, over and over and over again.
For better and worse, yeah. I think you can say. Absolutely.
No question. And also as a place that agglomerated capital. I mean, further to your question of what reminds us, what today reminds us of, it's impossible not to bring up the term the Gilded Age and today the Second Gilded Age.
Yes. Things seem to go in cycles, never quite never fully replicating the earlier cycle, but you do see these patterns. And I think Jessica would agree with me in saying that one thing we've discovered just in the short time that the book has been out, that we've had bankers and financiers say to us, I never knew any of this, or I didn't know a lot of it. And in fact, you know, there are lessons to be learned here, perhaps about hubris, about, you know, we're the brightest, the best and the brightest sitting on Wall Street. And the subprime mortgage market can never, ever, ever melt down because our calculations and computers say that it can't. Really echoes earlier moments of overconfidence.
Or maybe historians and journalists learn the lessons of hubris whereas on Wall Street itself, they're just chomping at the bit at the restraints that government is putting on them, saying, let us loose. We know what we're doing. Why do the banks stay here anymore? If it's warmer in Charlotte, they're less regulated in London. They don't need a trading floor anymore, just a smartphone. And so many New Yorkers hate them so much.
Yeah.
Why are we still the capital of capital, and will we be tomorrow?
Well, because cities are central. We see this, again, going back to the very beginning of our story. You can take it back to the merchants who needed money, so the banks developed there. And then you had insurance companies and accountants, and then you had lawyers. And no matter how much we move into a digital age, that face-to-face interaction, the human capital, the ability to work with all of these ancillary and critical companies and businesses, that's essential.
Yeah, there's a density that's unrivaled. And actually, there's another point that Jessica and I were talking about earlier. I heard Richard Ravitch on this station recently.
He was here on the
yes,
show.
Yes, that's
recently.
What I thought. Yeah, he was talking to you. And one of the things that jumped out in your conversation with him was at some point he said, you know, New York is still the incubator. It's still the magnet. It still draws the talent. It still draws the intelligence. And people are excited about being here. And that doesn't seem to be waning. I mean, Lord knows, just walking outside, I mean, there's no shortage of very, very, very wealthy and successful people who want to be in New York if the construction projects are any evidence. And so you still have that that draw. And I think that that will continue despite all the amenities of the digital age and the attractions of other money centers around the world. That will continue.
And when Richard Florida, for example, the urban theorist, talks about cities attracting the creative class, that includes musicians, designers, and people in finance.
It's true.
And the people in finance who want to take advantage of the creativity and cultural opportunities that are here.
Exactly.
And want to raise their kids here or near here at any rate.
So is the museum exhibition still up?
No, the museum exhibition actually was in 2012. So it's amazing to think back to creating the exhibition when the city was still very much feeling the brunt of the 2008 crisis. There was Occupy Wall Street. I went into the, you know, the Occupy Wall Street archives to get material. But it lives on in this book. We felt there needed to be a book to expand upon it and provide this history.
This book called Capital of Capital, Money, Banking, and Power in New York City, 1784 to 2012. Historian Stephen Jaffe, Museum of the City of New York curator Jessica Lawton. Thank you both so much. Great conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.